Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Morning Joe starts right now, a weekend after the Orioles swept the Red Sox. Not something I ever thought I would get to say, Joe.
No, it was rough. It was rough. Took my boys up to Fenway, and one of my sons told me right before we were about to be shut out in the first game, said, "You know, Dad, the Red Sox haven't been shut out in their home opener at home since your 11th birthday." I go, "That's bad." And then yesterday I hear the Red Sox haven't been swept their opening series since Harry Truman was president. I don't know. By next week, we may be going all the way back to the Magna Carta. I'm hoping, for the Red Sox' sake, though, Casey, that the Orioles are like the 27 Yankees this year, because that's what they look like in Fenway.
Well, look, Joe, I got to tell you, the Orioles have not won a World Series in my lifetime, which I think says more about them than it does about me, but who knows? I will also say it was good. I'm sorry that you guys were there to witness that. I know everyone wants the home team to win. Seeing Trey Mancini come back on the field after beating colon cancer, three runs batted in, three RBIs. I think it was a really, really great message to everyone that you can really come back strong from something tough. So, let's go O's.
Yeah, that was a positive story and a great weekend. Thank you so much, Casey. We really appreciate you talking about this weekend. It was incredible to be back in Fenway, incredible to be there sharing it with my kids. They only had 13% of the seats that were occupied, a far cry from what the Texas Rangers are doing right now. I think they can kind of meet somewhere in the middle. But I hope you had a great weekend. With us this morning, we have host of MSNBC's Politics Nation and president of the National Action Network, Reverend Al Sharpton, professor at Princeton University, Eddie Gloud Jr., and founder of the conservative website The Bulwark, and author of How the Right Lost Its Mind, Charlie Sykes. We also have former chief of staff to the DCCC, Adrian Elrod. She recently worked for the Biden campaign and the inaugural committee. Mika and Willie have the morning off, and it was quite a weekend, Rev. Easter weekend, but also, obviously, yesterday, remembering the passing of Martin Luther King over half a century later, 53 years later.
Yes, it was. The irony of the day is, as we that are Christians celebrate the resurrection, many of us in this country and in the civil rights community remembered the assassination of Dr. King. I was 13 years old when he was assassinated and had already become youth director of his New York chapter of Operation Breadbasket. And I thought about, as we are in the midst of this trial of Derek Chauvin in Minneapolis around the killing of George Floyd, as we're dealing with voter suppression laws in Georgia and 43 other states, how far we have come and how far we have not come since Dr. King's assassination. But then I'm reminded of his last book entitled "Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community?" We are still confronted with those choices. But in his last message the night before his assassination, he predicted. He said, "We'll have some difficult days ahead, but I want you to know that we as a people will get to the promised land." And that's what drives many of us that remain in that tradition of Dr. King. He promised us we'd get to the promised land no matter how difficult the days may seem.
One of the more extraordinary speeches in American history, the speech he gave that night in Memphis on April the 3rd, 1968, the night before he was assassinated, talked about seeing the promised land, and he might not get there with you, but he talked about that we as a country were going to reach that promised land. And here we are 53 years later, and by many metrics, we've moved miles and miles and miles as a country on the issue of race and other metrics. Not so much. And this Easter weekend, obviously, a city like Minneapolis still on edge over a possible racial showdown in the coming week or weeks.
Absolutely, Joe. It was a powerful weekend. You know, Resurrection Sunday, for those of us who are Christians, is an extraordinarily important day. I'm thinking about what Rev just said, though. You know, we often run past that line in King's famous speech. We have some difficult days ahead. You know, it's like running past Holy Saturday in order to get to Resurrection Sunday. You know, we have to deal with what Saturday represents as Christians in some ways. And so I think those difficult days he spied, we're still in. But again, he gave an Easter Sunday speech in April 27, 1957, where he talked about the power of love, the importance of love, how love can outlast, right, the ugliness of the period, of the moment. And so here we are in these difficult days. If we stand on the power of love, we can imagine rising again, it seems to me. It can actually happen.
And during his Easter Sunday address, Pope Francis called on the world to end violence, to end poverty, and to end the pandemic. Pope Francis called upon the leaders of the wealthy nations to display the, quote, spirit of global responsibility by speeding up the vaccination distribution and share the, quote, essential tool to end the pandemic with poorer nations. The United States is now administering more than 3 million new vaccine shots daily. The CDC also reported a record 4.1 million new doses that were given out on Saturday. The agency says just over 104 million Americans, or 31% of the population, have received at least one dose of the vaccine. Nearly 60 million people, or 18% of the population, are fully vaccinated. The CDC says it's now safe for fully vaccinated people to travel. Americans traveling within the U.S. can now do so without needing a COVID test or quarantining. If you're leaving the country, you also don't need a test unless the place you're visiting asks for it. And when you're coming back from an international trip, you should get a negative test before flying and get another test upon arrival. The guidance hasn't changed for Americans who aren't fully vaccinated, though, as their urge to avoid traveling. These changes come after TSA reported the most passenger screening since the start of the pandemic on Friday. Charlie, so I went up, as I said, I went up to Boston with my boys, and we watched the Red Sox, a difficult week. And I will tell you, seriously, what was more difficult for me was driving through Boston. The city is abandoned. You know, we mock, and for good reason, many of the things that Ron DeSantis say. We've been very concerned about Florida. You look at a lot of the pictures, and there's just rank irresponsibility. He seems to be trying to, quote, own the libs with every statement he makes. At the same time, you go to the other extreme. And look at what Charlie Baker and the state of Massachusetts is doing. I'm telling you, it's like going back 10 months. Almost all the buildings were shut down. Almost all the restaurants were shut down. I know a lot of the schools are shut down. I mean, there is a happy medium between there. Yeah. And with a mental health care crisis exploding the way it is right now, and every mental health provider I talk to says, we are now at a tipping point. Charlie, I know you, like me, we're conservatives, but we've been urging caution through this pandemic.
Yeah.
I think the caution now goes to the other side. People need to start opening up. We've got one out of three Americans at least partially vaccinated. 4 million Americans got vaccinated on Saturday. Deaths and hospitalizations are plunging. It is time to open every school. It is time to start opening up cities like Boston. The mental health of Americans requires it with all of these vaccines already in the arms of Americans.
Well, you're right. We're in this race, though. We're in the race between the vaccination and the herd immunity, and then the recklessness of, you know, some people in, you know, the country who are not observing any of the limits whatsoever. But you're right. Look, this country is it's pent up demand. It's like a wound spring that people are just ready to get back to their lives. And you mentioned getting back to school. Look, this has got to be the number one priority. You know, and this is not a good look from some of the teachers unions who are continuing to resist going back to school, even after they've been vaccinated. Look, we got to get the kids back to school. We're not going to get back to normal until we do that. The science would make it seems to make it very, very clear that you can reopen the schools without a significant health danger. So absolutely, we need to get back to school. Here in Wisconsin, we're much more open than you described in Boston. We're not yet at Florida levels. But, you know, I guess my concern is that we're at the, 3-yard line right now. Let's not spike the football at the 3-yard line. Let's take all of the precautions. But the clock is ticking. Look, I mean, you know, by the end of this month, by the beginning of May, people are going to go back to their lives, whatever the rules are, whatever the guidelines are, whatever the shutdown rules are.
Yeah, the clock is ticking, but we're not on the 3-yard line as it pertains to schools. A month ago, Anthony Fauci and others were saying it's time to get kids back in school. I'm sorry if politicians are scared of teachers unions. I really am. If you're really that weak that you're not going to do what's in the best interest of children after Anthony Fauci is telling you to open up the schools, I feel sorry for you. Because you need to do what's in the kids' best interest. And you know what? Again, let me be very clear. We're not at Easter of 2020 when Donald Trump was recklessly saying open the country. We're at Easter. We're past Easter of 2021 when 1 in 3 Americans have had at least one of their vaccinations. And we had 4 million vaccination shots given the other day. We have made great advances over the last year. We understand what causes COVID and what doesn't cause COVID. There is no reason why buildings across Boston and this country can't open up, at least partially open up, where N95 masks require 6-foot distancing, have proper ventilation. Enough is enough. Follow science. It's what we were saying when we were criticizing Donald Trump. That's what we're saying now. Follow the science. And if you follow the science, every school should be opened in America. Adrian, I know it's a balancing act. I know that a lot of people have looked at what's happened over the past year and looked at the recklessness of the former president, looked at the recklessness of certain Republican governors who are more interested than owning the libs than they are following science and medicine. At the same time, aren't we getting really close to the point where cities, towns, businesses, small businesses, restaurants should be allowed to open up across the country?
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. I mean, you talk about that happy median, striking that balance. That's exactly what we're looking for. You have states like Florida, Arkansas, my home state, that have taken this, I think, to the farthest extreme by lifting the mask mandate, not helpful. You have states like Massachusetts, as you mentioned, that probably need to be a little bit more aggressive in terms of opening up businesses. But Joe, I want to mention something when you talk about what's in the best interest of kids and sending kids back to school. It's also in the best interest of parents. There's a lot of parents out there who simply cannot afford to stay home with their kids. That we don't have a federal paid leave policy. The Biden administration has made it clear that that's something that they are hoping will be passed in maybe one of the next upcoming stimulus bills. But it's something that's got to be focused on here because you just don't, not every parent in this country has the luxury of staying home and taking care of their kids. So that's something that governors across the country have got to be focused on. And it's something that, you know, we've got to take into consideration when it comes to the interest of the kids.
And, you know, Rev, Adrian brings up a great point. I'm talking about the children. Obviously, again, I want to keep going back and underlining the mental health crisis, which has been very tough throughout the year. But again, talking to mental health providers, it's getting worse by the day. And we are reaching a critical moment right now where where kids have to get back into school. But Adrian brings up a great point. There are a lot of parents that can't continue to be staying at home, staying away from their job, being distracted from their job. This has a disproportionate impact, especially on working class and middle class Americans who can't afford a nanny, can't afford a babysitter day in and day out.
Not only does it have a disproportionate impact on working class parents, it has a disproportionate impact on those youngsters that are in broadband desert areas that can't go to school online because it's not available to them. So when you compound the fact that we have large swaths of the community that I come from that have been victimized by broadband deserts, you compound that with the mental health issue and by parents and some of them single mothers that can't afford to stay home. It is time to go back to school, particularly when vaccinations have been so widespread now. It is even more necessary for those that have been disproportionately impacted.
And Eddie Gloud, you also look at the financial crunch that working class and middle class Americans have been through. You also you look at the disproportionate impact that this pandemic has had, not just economically, not just medically, but also economically on people of color. And when I'm driving past those buildings in Boston, one after another, after another, after another, shut down, you know, the people that run the building, the executives in that building, they're watching their money multiply in the stock market over the past year. This past year has been one of the best year for the top 1%. But it's when those every day, Charlie Baker allows those buildings to stay shut down every day. People can't go back to work. It's not the top 1% that are being damaged. For the most part, it's working class Americans, working class Bostonians, middle class Americans, middle class Bostonians, and not just in Boston, but across the country. The people who are feeling the disproportionate impact of us not opening this country back up when one out of three Americans have been vaccinated, when the majority of Americans, are moving toward toward immunity. We've got to get this country open back up for working class and middle class Americans, because you look again at the death rate, you look at the hospitalization rate, it's going down.
Right, Joe. I mean, it's going down. You're absolutely right. And we've seen and experienced COVID capitalism, where the top 1%, they've actually, they've multiplied their bank accounts, while everyday ordinary working people have struggled to keep their noses above water. We also know among our dead that the poor are disproportionately represented. Black people, people of color, poor people, or white poor people are disproportionately represented among that extraordinary number of American dead. I think part of what we have to emphasize is I'm listening to you, and I think you're right in this regard. We have to follow the science. We have to follow the science. We have to be deliberate. But we also see at the same time, we have to acknowledge that the variants of COVID-19 is having an impact. Look at what's happening in Michigan. So we have to be deliberate in how we do this so that we don't wind up in a position where we have to do all of this all over again. But I think you're absolutely right. In terms of mental health, we're on the brink. We need to figure out how to do this in a reasonable way. We have examples of how not to do it, but we need to begin to open up, Joe. I agree with that point.
And by the way, a balanced approach, Eddie, you're exactly right. You look at those pictures out of Florida where people are jammed together, no masks, no social distancing. There is a happy medium. Follow the science, follow medicine, open up, require N95 masks, require 6 feet of distancing, make sure that you have proper ventilation, do all of those things. It can be done. And it needs to be done for working class Americans. It needs to be done for our children. It needs to be done for the millions and millions of Americans who are at the breaking point. This now has become, I think, a mental health crisis that is now perhaps even more urgent than where we are in the COVID crisis. If you look at the number of vaccinations, the 4 million vaccinations that were given on Saturday, the fact that the number of deaths are going down, the fact that the number of hospitalizations are going down. And they said, yeah, there are variants. There are variants we need to be concerned about. Well, we have therapeutics. We have N95 masks. We know what works. We know that 6-foot distancing works. We know that proper ventilation works. I think it's the responsibility of governors. It's the responsibility of leaders to figure out how to strike that happy medium between Boston and Miami Beach. Still ahead on Morning Joe, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp hits back after Major League Baseball decides to move the summer's All-Star game out of Atlanta amid backlash over the state's new voting law. How does Georgia's election law compare to other states? Plus, scores of supporters of former President Trump unknowingly donated, and this is a heartbreaking story, unknowingly donated more money to his campaign than they wanted to, according to the New York Times investigation. In fact, the Trump campaign may have accounted for 3% of credit card fraud complaints in the entire country. You're watching Morning Joe. We'll be right back.
Today and every day, Planned Parenthood is committed to ensuring that everyone has the information and resources they need to make their own decisions about their bodies, including abortion care. Lawmakers who oppose abortion are attacking Planned Parenthood, which means affordable, high-quality, basic health care for more than 2 million people is at stake. The right to control our bodies and get the health care we need has been stolen from us. And now, politicians in nearly every state have introduced bills that would block people from getting the sexual and reproductive care they need. Planned Parenthood believes everyone deserves health care. It's a human right. That's why they fight every day to push for common sense policies that protect our right to control our own bodies and against policies that interfere with decisions between patients and their doctor. Planned Parenthood needs your support now more than ever. With supporters like you, we can reclaim our rights and protect and expand access to abortion care. Visit PlannedParenthood.org/future. That's PlannedParenthood.org/future.
Well, we're watching the game. I think it was the opening game up in Boston. Word came across that Major League Baseball was moving the All-Star game out of Atlanta because of the new voting bill that passed out of Georgia. Obviously, it caused a firestorm. And Georgia Governor Brian Kemp criticized that decision and also criticized several Atlanta-based companies as backlash over the state's new voting law continues. So it was Friday, actually, that MLB announced it was going to be moving the upcoming All-Star game out of Atlanta to a ballpark in another state. That news had the governor hitting back over the weekend, even comparing voting laws in Georgia to those in New York State, where Major League Baseball is headquartered.
Major League Baseball caved to fear and lies from liberal activists. They ignored the facts of our new election integrity law, and they ignored the consequences of their decision on our local community. Georgians and all Americans should know what this decision means. It means cancel culture and partisan activists are coming for your business. They're coming for your game or event in your hometown. And they're coming to cancel everything from sports to how you make a living. In New York, they have 10 days of early voting. In Georgia, we have a minimum of 17, with two additional Sundays that are optional for all counties in our state. In New York, you have to have an excuse to vote by absentee. In Georgia, you can vote absentee for any reason, and you can do it securely. It's easier to vote in Georgia than it is in New York. Even more ridiculous is that MLB didn't cite a single reason that they disagreed with the bill in their statement. Everyone standing here today, and those at home, know why. Because the facts and the truth don't support their narrative.
So that's really the question. What are the facts? What's the truth? And was this reaction by Major League Baseball extreme? It's a question that was explored by election analyst and sort of the data guru when it comes to elections for the New York Times, Nate Cohn, in his latest piece titled Georgia's Election Law. and why turnout isn't easy to turn off. In it, Cohn writes in part this: there's a real and bipartisan misunderstanding about whether making it easier or harder to vote, especially by mail, has a significant effect on turnout or election outcomes. The evidence suggests it does not. It's possible the law is intended to do exactly what progressives fear: reshape the electorate to the advantage of Republicans. Soon after an electoral defeat, making it harder to vote. And yet the law's voting provisions are unlikely to, this is Cohn speaking, the voting provisions are unlikely to significantly affect turnout or Democratic chances. It could plausibly even increase turnout. And the final outcome, it will probably be hard to say whether it had any effect on turnout at all. That's Nate Cohn, the New York Times election data expert. So let's take a closer look at what the new law does and what the new law does not do. And I'm doing this so you can actually look and make up your own mind instead of having people telling you what you should or shouldn't believe. And check this out. This is all in the Times. It's all in the Wall Street Journal. It's all in the Washington Post. It's all out there. Producers done a good job breaking this down. Under the new law, Georgians are going to have at least 17 days of early voting, including two Saturdays, as the governor said, with an option of Sundays as well. Now, the law before the pandemic, in the last election in 2018, used to require only one Saturday for early voting. Precincts that had long lines in the past elections, and Georgia, my God, they had some of the longest in the country, are now required to add machines, are now required to add staff, are required to split the precinct, which a lot of these precincts need to be split. On that, Nate Cohn writes, it could be a big win for voters in Georgia's urban areas, who have dealt with some of the longest lines in the country. But those voting by mail will be required to provide ID. And the window to request and return an absentee ballot is shorter than it was in 2018. Runoffs are going to be held 4 weeks after the initial election instead of 9 weeks after. That squeeze in early voting to just 1 week, down from three. Ballot drop boxes, which had not been part of Georgia voting until the pandemic, when they were added under emergency rules for COVID, now there are drop boxes that are actually written into the law. There are limits, though, on the number in each county. And while some drop boxes in the last election were outdoors and unusable at all hours, they must now be indoors and accessible only during early voting hours. So instead of being accessible all hours, now only during early voting hours. Now, with this law in place, Georgia will still have no excuse absentee voting. In that respect, the governor's right. It's far more permissive than New York State, which has a Democratic governor, a Democratic legislature, and allows only limited absentee voting. New York also has fewer days of early voting, just nine, compared to Georgia's minimum of 17. And again, as the Georgia governor would tell you, that's New York is where MLB is based. New Jersey was just praised last month for a law that expanded early voting. It went up to 9 days, or about half of what Georgia has now. And critics of the law, including President Biden, have singled out the restriction. I have too, the restriction on handing out water to voters in line. But that same provision states, quote, this code section shall not be construed to prohibit a poll officer from making available self-service water from an unattended receptacle to an elector waiting in line to vote. Another state with restrictions on bringing water to voters in line? You guessed it, New York. Under New York state law, refreshments given out must be worth less than a dollar, and the people giving them out cannot openly identify with a candidate. Violations of that rule is a Class A misdemeanor. I got to say, so you're probably balancing these things like I am, saying, OK, little of this, little of that. It's kind of hard to figure out how a lot of these provisions compare to New York, to New Jersey, to other states, some Delaware, where some blue states are even more restrictive than Georgia. The big concern, I think, for people that have really read this closely, And what's concerned me the most has been the action by Georgia. And this is also what's concerned Georgia-based company MLB is and you look at the shock of the post-Trump era and what happened on January 6th. The problem is that the law was drafted in the first place in the face of essentially zero voter fraud in the 2020 election. And so you just have to be you have to ask yourself, why in the world would they create this new law, even if it does expand voting in some areas and constricts it in others? If you had Georgia's own Secretary of State repeatedly denying that there was widespread voter fraud in the last election. So the question you have to ask, and the provision that concerns me the most, where the state can actually step in and take over local election officials' decision-making process. Question you have to ask is, well, if there weren't any problems in the last election, what's the need for a new bill? Here is the Secretary of State of Georgia last December.
We've never found systemic fraud, not enough to overturn the election. We have over 250 cases right now. We reached out to the governor and asked for additional manpower resources with GBI. It gives us additional reach so we can finish up these investigations quickly. But right now, we don't see anything that would overturn, you know, the will of the people here in Georgia.
No, he said what every Trump judge said. He said what every Trump justice said on the Supreme Court. Trump appointed no widespread voter fraud. Nobody found widespread voter fraud. And Raffensperger, as Secretary of State, has also been chair of the State Board of Elections. Now, the legislature that was criticizing him during the recounts is going to pick the chair of the board and a majority of the members. The Secretary of State becomes a non-voting member. The State Board's going to have the authority to take over local election boards under certain circumstances. Again, my greatest concern and the concern of a lot of people. And last fall, when Georgia's governor faced pressure from President Trump to intervene in vote counting, he said the Secretary of State had the authority over elections that cannot be overridden. The new law gives some of that authority to the legislature, which has been under Republican control now for almost two decades. That may be the scenario President Trump was looking for in other battleground states last fall. That's when Trump invited top Michigan Republicans to the White House just days before the state certified its vote tally. But according to the AP, they told Trump they had no authority when it came to awarding electoral votes. One final thing. Critics have likened Georgia's law to Jim Crow era voting rules.
I'm convinced that we'll be able to stop this because it is the most pernicious thing. This makes Jim Crow look like Jim Eagle. I mean, this is gigantic, what they're trying to do. And it cannot be sustained. I do everything in my power, along with my friends in the House and the Senate, to keep that from becoming the law.
Again, I understand the reaction to what happened on January the 6th. I understand the skepticism on why Georgia would change voting laws. And change voting laws when actually there was no widespread voter fraud just a month or two ago. But we need to be precise in our criticism. Here's what Jim Crow era voting looked like in Georgia. The state established a poll tax in 1871 and later added a requirement that citizens pay back taxes in order to vote. By one estimate, that cut black turnout in Georgia in half. In 1907, Georgia added a literacy test for voters, but a number of exemptions allowed white Georgians to vote, even if they failed that test. Not so for black voters. In the early 1900s, Georgia's Democratic Party explicitly blocked non-white voters from participating in their primaries. So it does seem we're quite a way from Jim Crow 2.0. But let's bring in right now Chair in Constitutional Law for the Ohio State University, Ned Foley. Ned, a lot thrown at you, a lot thrown at Americans right now, trying to sort through this Georgia law. My question to you is, does this Georgia law look like, quote, Jim Crow 2.0, as its critics have suggested and that Major League Baseball has suggested? or is it a bit more ambiguous?
Each year, the International Rescue Committee's Emergency Watch List report assesses the 20 countries at greatest risk of new or worsening humanitarian emergencies. These countries are home to only 10.6% of the world's population, but carry a disproportionate burden of global humanitarian crisis. The civil war in Sudan has left over 24 million in need of humanitarian aid, while armed conflicts and natural disasters have displaced 1.26 million people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And Gaza has become the deadliest place for civilians in the world. Donations help the IRC provide families affected by humanitarian crises with emergency supplies in the aftermath of a crisis and with the resources they need to recover and rebuild their lives for the long term. Just $14 can provide a temporary shelter for a displaced family, and $72 can provide 2 months' worth of emergency food for a child. Donate today by visiting rescue.org/rebuild.
Well, I think you're right. That was a great summary, by the way, and I'd like to give it to my students, if that's okay, because it really laid out all the detail. So, you know, and what I particularly liked was that you focused on before and after, as well as side by side. But what I mean by that is there's two ways to look at a change in voting rules. And one is compared to what it was previously. And by that measure, there's a lot of different parts to this new bill. Some are expansions, meaning it's easier to vote if there's more days of early voting. Some of it is a bit of a contraction. The rules on absentee voting, for example, while more generous than New York, are more restrictive than what Georgia had previously. And part of the reason why that before versus after comparison is important goes back to something I think you and I talked about previously, which is the Shelby County decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, which referred to a part of the Voting Rights Act, which was specifically about that before and after perspective. Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act said states weren't able to make changes to voting rules, the covered states, like some of the ones in the South, without proving that it wasn't making things worse off for the voters who had previously experienced elections. And so some of the provisions, I think, in the new Georgia law do look a little bit worse off. Particularly your point was like, why was it necessary? Georgia ran a really good election in November 2020. Why make some of these changes, including the food and water change in particular? On the other hand, if you don't take that before and after perspective and you look side by side to New York or New Jersey, Georgia doesn't look so bad. So I do think it is a nuanced, multifactored story that has multiple components. And I think you are absolutely right that the most dangerous feature of the law is the one that you pointed out to, which takes the power away from the incumbent Secretary of State, who did such a good job for voter integrity and election integrity last year when President Trump asked for a manipulation of the voting process. The Secretary of State said, no, we do it properly. We count everybody's vote and we count every vote fairly. And he made some very good decisions. And it looks like this law is in part revenge for him standing up for the truth and standing up for fairness. And that's what's most worrisome to me.
Yeah, it really is worrisome. Let's talk, though, state-by-state comparisons, because I think Major League Baseball right now would probably be better off being based in Minnesota or Oregon or other states that don't have the restrictive voting laws that New York State has. I mean, New York State's just been seen as a nightmare. When I called my friends during 2020, even in the early voting, they all said the same thing. I want to vote. I really, really feel compelled to be a part of this election, but it's a 3-hour wait. And I heard that time and time again. Not only does New York have some of the most restrictive voting laws, they have some of the most restrictive ballot access laws for people who want to run for office. So talk about how New York, which actually only has limited absentee voting, while Georgia actually has kept in place no excuse absentee voting and have 9-day early voting days compared to Georgia's 17 early voting days at a minimum. Talk about how Major League Baseball's argument certainly is made weaker by the fact that they are based in a state that has, in some ways, even more restrictive voting laws than Georgia.
Well, that's absolutely true. It's been well known among election law scholars and practitioners that New York has been an outlier in a bad way, you know, for years in terms of limited access to voting and really antiquated and, you know, old-fashioned voting. I mean, it used to be decades ago, the model was a single day of voting on election day with very limited vote by mail or absentee voting. But many other states around the country expanded in order to give voters more choice, more opportunity without sacrificing integrity. Ohio has done that. Florida has done that. Many other states have done that, but not New York. New York was was behind the times, as it were, and still stuck to that very old-fashioned, very restricted method. You know, I think New York is finally trying to catch up a little bit, but again, you know, their expansion leaves them, and New Jersey's still leaves them with fewer days of early voting than many other states.
All right. Thank you so much. Chair in Constitutional Law at The Ohio State University, Ned Foley. And Ned, Mika's going to be very excited when I tell her that your cat joined in on the shot and was a co-star in that hit. Thank you. Thank you so much for being... You saw that, yeah. I thought you worked through it very well. Okay, thank you so much, Ned. We hope to see you back soon. So, Rev, let me bring you in here, going through the facts. Talk about your biggest concern and how we balance some of these things out. And I just got to ask, based on sort of what we're learning, because this is the first time that a lot of people really dug into New York. I know you've probably spent your life trying to make New York a place where it's easier to vote, or New Jersey, other than working on New York also to expand their voting rights. What are your takeaways on this debate? And do you think Major League Baseball did the right thing?
I think that Major League Baseball did do the right thing. I think what's missing in a lot of the reporting is that the players began saying they did not want to play in Georgia. And this was not just a corporate decision by Major League Baseball. The players were saying that based on the allegations unproven and untrue by Donald Trump is why the Georgia legislature went back in to change some of the things. If you compare Georgia to New York, obviously, New York is looks worse, and many of us have been fighting that for all of our careers to open the doors in New York. But Georgia went back in after already changing things. Let's not forget, Governor Kemp had changed some things his last race to beat Stacey Abrams. Now you go back in again because you want to react to what Trump said. I think that is what escalated this. Because you had just made certain changes. You had just closed certain voting sites. You had done a number of changes in Georgia in the last gubernatorial race that many of us felt was unfairly stacked against Stacey. Now you're incited by Donald Trump. You removed the Secretary of State to where now, if Donald Trump could have called other people, he may have won the state of Georgia. I think that's what escalated this. But in a comparison to New York, I think they win. In a comparison to themselves, they'd have to explain why are you keep changing the rules after each election? Is it because the results are not what you say? And why are the rules always where it disproportionately impact where it's been large black turnout?
Yeah. And Eddie, if you look at the side-by-side comparisons of Georgia and New York, the Rev's right. In many instances, New York actually compares unfavorably. The biggest question that has been asked from the beginning of this process has gone to the intent of the legislature. And why did the legislature go back in, change these voting rules when there was no evidence, no court found evidence of widespread voter fraud? So if you go down line by line, in many instances, Georgia actually did expand voting. Georgia did expand other areas, guaranteed for the first time drop boxes. But again, you still have to go back and you have to ask really one of the most important questions. Well, why did they do this in the first place if, well, the Secretary of State, who's a Republican, other Republican officials in Georgia. Trump appointed judges in Georgia. Trump appointed Georgia's judges across the country, all said the same thing. There was no spread, no widespread voter fraud. So what exactly were they trying to fix?
Joe, I think that's the question. And of course, there's the historical backdrop. When we compared Georgia to the state of New York, let's just ask a basic question. I don't have the answer, so I'm doing something that lawyers don't do. How often has New York been sued in terms of denying the right voting rights of minority its minority citizens or black people? And how often has Georgia has been sued in relation to that practice? And I think it's very important. I understand the effort to be balanced here, but you're absolutely right. We're trying to extend good faith to Kemp and the Republican legislature in terms of this particular piece of legislation. If you do that, then you kind of offer the kind of analysis that Cohn has offered. But when we think about it as a kind of crude and crass political gesture in light of, not even a gesture, act, in light of what we just saw in the presidential election and in the Senate runoff, we see this as a crude and crass power grab on the part of the Republican Party. When we talk about, I'm looking at an earlier piece in the New York Times about that vote, about the law. Early voting is expanded in a lot of small counties, but probably not in the more populous ones. We talked, you already talked about what's going on with the state election board and the suspension of county election officials and what that would mean for the democratic process. I could go through a whole range of other elements of that law which suggest that it wasn't passed in good faith. So part of what I want us to do is to understand it for what it is, a crude and crass political act. I understand the polemics around the analogy. Oftentimes we use Jim Crow as a way of calling attention to what seems to be a cynical racist action. And oftentimes that analogy, Joe, does more harm. It obscures more than it illuminates. But what we need to understand is that this is a crude political, I keep using that word, a crude and crass political act aimed at securing power on the part of white Republican men in the state of Georgia.
So let's Charlie Sykes, I read a good bit of Nate Cohn's article that a lot of people were talking about yesterday, where Nate Cohn said, correctly, we don't know what turnout's going to be in 2022. Right. And I say this as a Republican that have heard Democrats complaining and Republicans complaining for a quarter of a century about how turnout is going to be knocked down or turnout's going to be affected by this voting law or that voting law. And nobody really knows. You know, we, my God, how many days, how many weeks, how many months did we talk about the post office? They were going to rig and fix this election and stop voter turnout. We had extraordinary voter turnout this election. So Nate Cohn's point, we don't know what, how this is going to turn out. It's correct. We'll know the day after the 2022 election. But I want to focus, Charlie, have you focus on two things, okay? Because it seems to me that's the heart of this. First is, do people need to pull back when they're calling this law Jim Crow 2.0? A lot of people have. Is that hyperbole? And is it doing what Eddie suggested, maybe more harm than good because it obscures other facts? And the second thing is, did MLB, did Major League Baseball overreact? Or, as the Rev said, were they just reacting to their players who said, hey, we're not going to go play there? Because as one person connected to Major League Baseball told me on Friday, if you have one player who decides not to show up at the All-Star game, then another player decides, then pretty soon you have things falling apart quickly. So those two things, Jim Crow, yeah, and Major League Baseball. Is it Jim Crow 2.0? And did Major League Baseball overreact?
Okay, so you've laid this out really well. And I think Eddie's point about this legislation being bad faith, what was the intention of this legislation? You know, based on the Donald Trump big lie about an election that, in fact, was free, fair, and completely secure. He's absolutely right about this. The other real concern ought to be about whether or not this does politicize the system and whether or not this makes it easier for Republicans to overturn, say, the 2024 election. The retaliation against Brad Raffensperger, I think, is a real red flag in this legislation. But having said that, there's no need to gild the lily then. If you look at, you know, the intention and the possible implications of this, you don't need to engage in the over-the-top rhetoric like Jim Crow 2.0. Jim Crow was a very specific thing. It was, and you laid out what it was. This bill has a lot of flaws, but I think the danger of over-the-top rhetoric is the risk of discrediting the attacks. And you're seeing this right now. The blowback among Republicans has been, you are misrepresenting this bill. And Governor Kemp, and I'm not a fan, lays out, as you have done, lays out the differences between the Georgia law and the New York law. And my concern is that what's happening is that some of the critics are losing their credibility and will make it harder, not easier, to fight against some of these voter suppression laws around the country. And so that's the problem when you go to, you know, DEFCON, you know, 1 or DEFCON 5, whatever, I always get that confused, and say, you know, this is Jim Crow 2.0. It's like, hey, well, then where do you go when, in fact, you have an overt attempt to overturn elections? What happens when you have an overt attempt to suppress the election? And by the way, I'm not defending the Georgia law in any way whatsoever. I'm just saying that the concerns are legitimate enough without going so far as to say that it's Jim Crow 2.0, specifically, as you pointed out, that it actually makes it easier to vote early. So MLB. Did they go too far? I think it's going to be interesting. Where are they going to go now, considering, you know, that some of these other states also have voter ID requirements, also have limited early access? What I think is interesting is watching the number of Republican senators and congressmen who are reacting to this by threatening legislative retaliation. We're kind of in a new era now where Republicans have decided to blend together their anti-corporate class warfare, culture war into one bundle. And they're going to be focusing on going after companies and businesses, threatening their tax breaks, threatening the antitrust exemption of Major League Baseball. This is going to be a very interesting new era. How much are they going to be willing to use government power to punish private entities that take political positions they don't like?
You know, it's interesting also. It seems a lot of these Georgia legislators, they don't understand the 49 other states. I'm sure Jacksonville, Florida would love to have Coca-Cola in their city limits. I saw it in Connecticut when I was living in Connecticut. There were legislators that kept insulting sure. General Electric. You know what General Electric did? Yeah. They moved to Boston. So again, it seems a little short-sighted, but we'll see. It is interesting though, as we talk about the All-Star Game, that the governor was talking about Stacey Abrams, that MLB listened to Stacey Abrams. No, actually MLB did not listen to Stacey Abrams because Stacey Abrams wanted the All-Star Game to stay in Atlanta, asked MLB to keep it in Atlanta. The same thing with John Ossoff, same thing with Ralph Warnock. They all said, please don't take this game out of Atlanta. Let's have the spotlight on this voting law by having the All-Star Game here. It's a better opportunity, and don't hurt people in this city. A lot of people in Georgia wish they'd listen to Stacey Abrams and the two Democratic senators. So, Adrian Elrod, let's talk about the provision that I think causes most concerns to most people who do see this as a power grab by Republicans. And that is where you're allowing the state legislature to take over and step in for the Secretary of State and step in for local election officials. I know you and I and so many people remember what was happening in Michigan with that young Republican election official that kept getting intimidated and knocked around because they wanted him to cheat. And he refused to cheat, and they couldn't step in. Same thing happened in Georgia. The same thing happened across the country with Donald Trump and other Republicans trying to intimidate these local officials. Talk about the danger of the Georgia law in respect to allowing the state legislature to step in and actually make decisions for the Secretary of State and even local officials.
Well, Joe, this is really the dangerous path that a law like this that was just passed in Georgia will create for other states. I mean, that's the fundamental thing here. Now that this law is passed in Georgia, we're seeing other states like Arizona, states that have Republican-held legislatures that are going to focus on passing a similar law. So make no mistake, this is a systematic effort that Republicans are taking across the country to try to restrict the rights of voters. And yes, of course, Governor Kemp comes forward and says, well, there's actually a couple of things that this law does to expand the rights of voters. And I'm so glad, Joe, that you and the show took this segment to where you did, because I think it's so important to look at the full picture. But when you take the 30,000 foot view and take a step back, it's important to also keep in mind that this is an effort that Republicans are taking across the country to make it that much harder for people to vote, which is why we got to look at the questions. Why in the world is Georgia trying to change their state law on this when there was no voter fraud that was found? Why are we turning anything over to the power of politicians, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican? But of course, in this case, it really is the Republicans that are doing this. And why are we trying to do anything to reject or make it difficult for voters to vote? Even if there are some areas that are expanded, the fact that there are many areas that are restricted in this law, why are we doing anything like that in this day and age when we should only be trying to expand the right for people to vote?
All right. Adrienne Elrod, thank you so much. As always, Charlie Sykes, Eddie Glaude Jr., thank you as well.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.